I'm delighted to have the opportunity to chair this session because we have the unique privilege of hosting a truly remarkable European political leader, a former prime minister, a leader of a political party, a major voice in his country's affairs. But not only a European political leader, a first-class, outstanding European diplomat, a person who thinks creatively, not only about the responsibilities of his own country, but who thinks in a larger and historically ambitious European context. A European political leader who has taken major responsibilities on his shoulders in recent years regarding crises, such as the Bosnian problem, regarding peacemaking, such as the Dayton Agreement, where he represented Europe, and who today is one, in my judgment, of the two or three truly outstanding European foreign ministers, whose vision goes beyond Europe, embraces the Atlantic relationship, and thinks more largely of the role that the West should and can be playing in world affairs. That makes this evening, that makes this event particularly important, because we are at a time at which it is extremely urgent that we on this side of the Atlantic and those on the other side of the Atlantic think seriously and creatively about how America and Europe can work together regarding the problems, and particularly the novel problems that the international community increasingly faces. As you know, or as some of you may know, in the last few hours, our Secretary of State made a major speech on the American-European relationship. I don't know if it was precipitated by the desire to beat you to the punch, or to define the setting for what you have to say, or to perhaps even impose a sense of direction on the American perspective regarding this issue. But in any case, I think it's a rather felicitous combination of speeches. United States Secretary of State addressing a somewhat similar set of issues from the American point of view, but keeping in mind Atlantic solidarity, and a European leader who has a similarly broad perspective and a sense of awareness of the interdependence and connectivity between these two Atlantic shored continents. So I'm particularly delighted to be able to present him to you because I have also a personal angle in all of this. I consider him to be a friend of mine, and one of my children is actually working in Sweden. So I'm particularly pleased to ask you, Carl, to take the floor. Yes, I'm having a problem with this one, not to shutting it off.
See if it works. I think it works now. Thanks very much for those remarks, and I have to say that I really find it difficult to think of a greater honor in Washington than to be introduced by Dr. Brzezinski. A fairly long time ago, when I was a student in the university, I was reading books by said Dr. Brzezinski. And I have to say that that is a habit I've not given up. During decades, there have been the one interesting, profoundly important book after the other. And the intellectual stimulus that you have given to strategic thought in this town, but in the wider Western community during the decades, is with extremely few parallels in our modern time. And although it might not be your decision or your influence only, the fact that we have a very close relative of yours serving as ambassador to Stockholm is, of course, something that we're also benefiting from. Then it's a delight to be here at CSIS, which has also been, over the years, a source of inspiration in the different works that CSIS has been producing on a number of different topics, and to make some remarks on the challenges that we are facing. You've just gone through a most important election. And if you look at the politics of Europe at this present time, it is, of course, dominated by very much by the different economic challenges. To an outside observer, it certainly looks like both Europe and the United States will be preoccupied for some time with what President Obama, during the election campaign and prior to that, referred to as nation building at home. That was a message we heard from the different debates during your campaign, and that is certainly a different phrase, but the message that we hear coming out of the different EU summits. It is a fact that large parts of the European Union will have to give the issues of debts and deficits far more attention in the years to come. And as both the deficits and the debt is, as a matter of fact, higher in the US economy than in Europe, the same will certainly apply here. And add to that the fact that we will have to face the challenge of the competitiveness of our economies coming from the fast-growing economies of primarily Asia, but also other parts of the world. Then we must, in Europe, somewhat less, but also in the United States, face the prospect of societies getting older in the decades ahead. After the challenge of debts and the deficits, we face the challenge of the aging of our societies. And it is indeed important that we face these challenges. They are grave, they are difficult, but they are certainly not insurmountable. If you look at what Europe has been going through in the last two, three, four, five decades, I would argue, in terms of both political and economic transition, I would say that the challenges that we face now are not more grave than what we've been able to master in the past. And we shouldn't hide the strength that are, after all, there. The economies of the Nordic and the Baltic world, and I'm proud to say that if you add them together, we are well within the 10th largest economies of the world. I think, as a matter of fact, roughly the 8th largest economies of the world. We are, in fact, doing relatively well. Much is now the issue about the issues facing the different economies of Southern Europe. But I think it would be a mistake, to underestimate the long-term effects of the reform shock that they are going through at the moment. There is certainly severe pain at the moment, but the gain further ahead could also be very substantial. Remember that it was only a decade ago or so that the Economist, on its cover, said that the sick man of Europe in economic terms was Germany. And go back a further decade in time, the same thing could well have been said about Sweden, not to mention the state of the economy of Turkey at that period in time. Opening up markets inside Europe by the deepening and the widening of our internal market, including also the very rapidly developing service and digital parts of our economies, as well as globally through free trade agreements, is clearly one of the important things that we have to give increased attention. As we speak, the European Union is negotiating free trade agreements with a number of countries. Canada, Singapore, India, countries in Latin America have concluded with South Korea and others. And as a matter of fact, earlier today, the Council in Brussels gave the green light and mandate to the Commission to start to negotiate a free trade agreement with Japan as well. Were we to implement fully only the free trade agreements that are now on the table being negotiated, it would add up to 60 billion euros to our economies every year. But the piece that is missing is, of course, the transatlantic part of the deal. I think there is a very strong argument in favor of now starting to focus on a transatlantic free trade agreement. There are obvious difficulties that must be confronted, that is always the case, but the benefits are immense. That is something that we need. There was a study that was done by one of our sort of trade research outfits in Sweden of the potential benefits, and they said at the minimum you would have an increase in trade in both directions across the Atlantic by 20%. And there isn't a politician in sight who wouldn't be able to translate that particular figure into figure for the new jobs in his or her constituency be that in the US or be that in Europe. And it has to be said, this is something that we truly need. But even as thus the economic and growth agenda, let's call it nation building at home, might be the mantra of the immediate future on both sides of the Atlantic, we ignore the outside world at our own peril. Much has been discussed about the famous US pivot to Asia. And there's no question that we must devote more attention to all of the issues of Asia. A number of good ones in terms of the economic progress that they are doing, but also some of the difficult issues that were there. I was a couple of weeks ago, we had a summit meeting between Europe and Asia and witnessed to a verbal duel between the Prime Minister of Japan and the Foreign Minister of China of a nature that is normally reserved, what we hear from the representatives of Armenia and Azerbaijan. That is not a good sign. We need to engage. But at the same time, we should not miss the symbolism of what happened just a couple of days ago. Secretary Clinton had to alter her schedule in Asia, rush to the Middle East to support the efforts to bring the latest round of fighting over Gaza to an end. And if there's one clear message from virtually everyone in Europe to Washington these days, it is this. There can be no pivoting away from all the dangers between the Nile and the Indus, and our responsibility to at least try to move them to peaceful resolution. Last week, Tom Friedman in the New York Times painted a rather grim picture of what might happen in the years to come. And I quote, "The whole Middle East erupts in one giant sound and light show of civil wars, states collapsing, and refugee dislocations as the keystone of the entire region, Syria, gets pulled asunder and the disorder spills across the neighborhood," end of quote. And during my, by now I think, more than 6 years as foreign ministers of one of the EU countries, I haven't seen either myself or my colleagues as worried by the trends in this wider region as is the fact today. There are certainly good and hopeful forces. The Arab Spring and what that brought forward. Egypt, which is having its difficult times as we speak, is moving forward after all. And go back a couple of years and there were far more difficult scenarios painted for what might happen in Egypt. The possibilities of a democratic consolidation in spite of the difficulties of the day should not be underestimated. And the long-term importance for the entire Arab world of what happens to Egypt, I think, is clear to all of us. But it is in the wider Levant that we see developments on a course that could lead to very problematic events. If there was one positive outcome of the Gaza war, which is debatable, it could at least be that it did refocus attention on the need to move forward towards a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. Policies of creating new facts on the ground through illegal settlements, as well as political trends in the region as a whole, are likely to make a two-state solution increasingly difficult in the years ahead. This is profoundly dangerous, since there is no realistic alternative if we want to avoid further confrontation, further strife, and further war. In my opinion, it would have been truly wise and far-sighted policy of both Israel and the United States to engage in supporting a resolution in the United Nations, rewarding the forces of peace by upgrading the status of Palestine to one of a non-member observer state. It would have been an even stronger endorsement of a negotiated, mutually agreed two-state solution. It would have facilitated the immediate resumption of direct talks between the parties to this end. And crucially, it would have been the best thing for the Palestinians, for Israel, and for the region as a whole. In fact, I have to say that I have heard no coherent and truly credible argument against such a step. After the vote in the United Nations, which I think is more or less imminent, or going on, or whatever it is. There are possible developments along either of two lines. Either one, that in some sort of whatever political revenge cuts funding to the Palestinian administration, pushing and perhaps even forcing it into the possibility of a collapse. There can be very little doubt which forces such a policy would play into the hands of. Or, alternatively, a policy that recognizes the overwhelming international support for a two-state solution and engages in immediate, open, and honest negotiations towards a such. The parameters for a solution are well established by the European Union and, to a very considerable degree, by the United States as well. Israel would be short-sighted not to see the opportunity, and the Palestinians would be foolish not to seize the moment. They would both have the support for a solution of the entire Western and the entire Arab world. I heard it repeated repeatedly during the presidential campaign that the United States is an indispensable nation in the world today. And to a large extent, and in theory, I would certainly agree with that. But now is the time to prove it in practice. And the peace process between Israel and Palestine is truly the place to do it. That the European Union is ready to be a strong partner for peace in this region goes without saying. This region is our immediate neighbor, not only on the map, but increasingly across the street back home. Close to 2% of the population of Sweden these days comes from Iraq. Approximately 1% of the population of Sweden comes from Iran, have their background there. We are home to the by far largest community of people from Syria in Europe. We have a profound interest in what is happening there. It affects directly our own society. The civil war in Syria has now claimed roughly four times as many lives as the war in Kosovo, approaching half the number killed in the long years of wars in Bosnia. But neither should we forget the even higher number of people killed during a decade of civil war in Algeria, or the still even higher number of people killed during the even longer civil war in Lebanon. There are no models, just tragedies and consequences for decades to come. The longer the fighting goes on, the more difficult will be the road back to some sort of stable state of Syria. And the greater will be the risk that we will face years of sectarian strife stretching from Beirut to Baghdad to Basra to Bahrain. Thus, we now ought to seek to re-engage the UN Security Council or its members in an effort to achieve the peaceful transition in Syria that is imperative and that everyone at the end of the day has an interest in and desires. There's a Geneva document that has been agreed by the P5 and others and can be the basis for peaceful and fast transition to the necessary post-Assad regime. There are those who want to see or believe that there is a purely military solution. But a profoundly fractured society and a seriously destroyed country will hardly be a base for stability in the years ahead. A political transition is difficult in nearly every respect. It might not even be possible. But the alternative, I would argue, is even more difficult in immediate humanitarian and in its long-term political consequences. And this, in my opinion, has to guide our policy in this truly difficult and challenging situation. A strong effort with the United States truly engaged to reach a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine would obviously help in this respect as well. It would avoid the impression of the United States and Europe just drifting away from the region. It would increase the respect for the totality of the efforts that we have in the region. And the same applies to the not least difficult issues of seeking a negotiated solution when it comes to the dispute with Iran over its nuclear program. The war drums over that particular issue have subsided slightly for the time being, and the true time for diplomacy has perhaps come now. We don't know. Iran has certainly missed many opportunities in the past, but so have we, clearly in 2003, and in my opinion, also in 2010. I don't think it is that difficult to imagine the contours of a possible deal, but it is less easy to see how we can go from here to there. There's an enormous gap of mistrust, primarily between the United States and Iran. There's a price to be paid in the domestic struggles of Tehran for moving towards compromise, and the same, by the way, could well apply in different Western capitals. But if you take a longer look at the issues between the United States and Iran today are hardly greater than they were between the United States and the China of Mao Zedong four decades ago. There was at the time, with very good reason, strong opposition to the way that China was governed. Millions after millions had perished under the brutal policies of the communist dictatorship. Direct and indirect wars had been fought with it in both Korea and in Indochina, but the strategic interest prevailed. An element of constructive ambiguity was necessary. There was certainly intense controversy at the time. Today, the wisdom of that move is hailed by each and everyone. It might not be possible to repeat this today with Iran. We might be set on a course for war that cannot be avoided. But as we are heading towards the year in which we will remember the catastrophe of the European summer of 1914, the absence of diplomacy, the abundance of emotions, the haphazard attitude to the risks of war, it's an imperative to try to avert a repetition. Tom Friedman's gloomy thought on what might lie ahead might turn into grim reality if we don't. We might face a new collapse between Israel and Palestine, a prolonged civil war stretching across the Levant, and the beginning of long-term conflict with Iran from Afghanistan to Mesopotamia. It is high time to pivot to a policy of peace for the entire volatile region between the Nile and the Indus. If you get the impression that we see this as a priority from a European point of view, I think you are certainly right. But there are, of course, a number of other issues where we need to work closely together and develop common policies. We certainly need to continue our commitment to the Balkans. We certainly have a profound common interest in engaging with Turkey and encourage its European accession path. And then, of course, there's always Russia. Today, it is still the most populous of the neighbors of the European Union. Within some decades, it will be challenged in that position by Egypt. Russia going down and Egypt going up. We have a deep and profound interest in the modernization of Russia. But it needs more than just a couple of new machines to call it modernization. It needs a new model of governance, opening up to the demands of a more modern and outward-looking society and facilitating its evolution to a more broad-based economy, competitive in the new global economy. There is, in my opinion, a new Russia emerging today. We see the weekend shoppers in thousands from St. Petersburg filling the boutiques of Helsinki and Stockholm. We see the vacationer in millions streaming to the holiday destinations of Turkey and Egypt. And I believe that this new Russia, over time, will also demand new policies. It seems strange indeed that the state budget today is radically increasing defense spending while at the same time reducing spending on health and education. It is, to put it mildly, not only the United States, not only the European Union, that would be wise to focus more on the internal challenges of reform. We have offered Russia a true partnership for modernization, but since it takes two to tango, progress so far has been fairly slow. Looking also towards our east, we have offered Ukraine as well as Moldova and Georgia association agreements that include what we call the comprehensive free trade agreements, the DCFTA in Eurospeak, a language that you need to become familiar with. These are very far-reaching agreements on economic harmonization and integration. Negotiations with Ukraine have been concluded, and there's the possibility that we can do the same with both Moldova and Georgia during the year to come. But where Ukraine is truly heading is not entirely easy to say. Political trials in combination with muddled policies of reform and an election that certainly left much to be desired has put a big question mark on our possibility to pursue these agreements. There's talk of whether Ukraine is going west or Ukraine is going east. I fear at the moment it is primarily heading down. But we will continue to engage with its leadership in order to give it better possibilities for the future. These are policies of long-term engagement for economic modernization, for the rule of the law, and for representative government towards our east. And over time, of course, we must seek to develop the same policies to the countries of the Middle East and North Africa, taking all of the obvious difficulties into account. In the past decades, if you look at them, they have not been able to benefit from the effect of globalization, and their growth has been well below that of the emerging economies. And with their very rapid population increases, they now have among the highest rates of youth unemployment that we find anywhere in the global economy. The so-called Arab Spring was to a very large extent a revolution of rising expectations driven by the young and driven by the educated. But the task ahead now is gigantic for these countries. The IMF is saying, and I quote, to absorb the unemployed and the new entrants to the labor force, these MENA emerging economies would require annual real GDP growth of more than 7.5%, almost 3 percentage points higher than the average achieved in the past decade. And this, obviously, is not doable without profound policies of reforms and profound policies of opening up of roughly the same sort as we saw Turkey implementing after it had adhered and became part of the customs union of the European Union in 1995. To achieve this, these reforms, this transformation and this growth is essential if we shall avoid the revolutions of rising expectations of now to turning into a revolution of failed expectations a couple of years down the road. And what the politics of that revolution could be, we cannot be certain of. But there are certainly alternatives that are not appealing. And here we are trying from the European side to do our best, moving forward with engaging them, because instability, turmoil and despair to our south is distinctly not in our interest. And this applies also as we are now, by the force of events, having to focus attention on the fragile belt of states immediately to the south of the Sahara. We have been moderately successful when it comes to the situation in Somalia, by the standards of Somalia, has to be said. We had to intervene in the politics of Chad a couple of years ago, and we haven't heard very much of Chad since. It's not a perfect place, but it's not the problem that it was then. But we are now clearly facing substantial challenges in Mali. When discussing security in the past, our focus is often on the territorial security of our nations, the way it has been since Westphalia in 1648. And for centuries, security was to a large extent a question of having the armies to prevent other armies from crossing our frontiers. But in this age of accelerating globalization, it is increasingly the flows across the borders and across the boundaries of the past that secures the prosperity and indeed the stability of our societies, we are starting to speak about what I call flow security. Securing the maritime trade routes in the Gulf of Aden, protecting the international air traffic system, facilitating the free and secure flow of the terabytes of data, now taking us into a world of true hyperconnectivity. Just one fact. In 5 years' time, mobile broadband use is likely to have grown by a factor of 15 and reach 85% of the population of the world. Here, the Atlantic nations have a key role as the standard bearers of globalization and integration. Our role as proposing the rules and helping to secure that they are adhered to will be of rapidly rising importance in the years to come. But as much as we have a role in promoting and protecting what I call the good flows, we have an increasingly important role in preventing the evil flows. You know this very well. The wars between the drug smugglers in Central America and Mexico is claiming more lives every year than the war in Afghanistan. And you can see the same danger elsewhere, in the fragile belt of the Sahel, with the different smuggling routes undermining states that were fragile also from the beginning. And we should not underestimate the dangers of the flows of drugs and weapons from Afghanistan, threatening the far from stable states of Central Asia in the years to come. You just have to look at the situation in Balochistan. This will require new forms of international cooperation to deal with. Missile defense might turn out to be far easier than drug defense, and failure might well be more costly for the stability of entire regions. But let me conclude with an area where we both see new international cooperation developing, and you might argue the dismal failure of international cooperation in our modern age. I'm talking of the high north of the Arctic that is turning into a fairly hot topic of global politics. There might still be, particularly here in the US, the occasional dissenter out there, but very few can deny the fact of global climate change of warning. Welcome to the Arctic. It's happening twice as fast up there as anywhere else. This summer has seen the ice cap receding further than at any recorded time before. On present trends, there will be ice-free summers in the Arctic in less than 3 decades. China sent its new icebreaker on a journey through the Bering Straits, north of Siberia, and to Iceland. And on its return journey, it went up to the North Pole, where, by the way, there was also, for the seventh time, the Swedish icebreaker Oden this summer. And as we speak, in late November, soon December being here, a Russian LNG tanker is on its way from Hammerfest in northern Norway to its destination in Japan. It will reach that destination 20 days faster than would otherwise have been the case. The 8 nations of the Arctic Council, now under the enlightened and wise chairmanship of Sweden, is developing new networks of cooperation in this increasingly important area. And we have, with the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, a sound legal basis for resolving outstanding issues. And in the constructive atmosphere for our work, we hope for making this region a region of true collaboration between all the countries concerned. So there we have, between the different parts of the Atlantic world, the United States and Europe, quite an agenda to deal with. We need to do the nation building at home, to reform our economies, to restore our credibility also on the international stage and get the confidence of our respective populations and electorates. We need to truly face all of the truly difficult and dangerous issues between the Indus and the Nile, because the consequences of failing will affect our societies as well. We need to engage the emerging powers of Asia. We need, from the European point of view, with support of the United States, to engage the countries of the east of Europe and to the south of the Mediterranean in policies of economic reform, of better governance, and the rule of the law. And we need to, together address the issues of governance in a world of hyperconnectivity and globalization, with perhaps the Arctic and global warming one of the symbols of both the changes that we see, the global warming that we've not been able to address, but also the potential for cooperation that is in that hitherto rather frozen part of the world. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Carl, for this remarkably wide-ranging and strategically far-reaching statement. I think everyone here must have been impressed by its scope and its pertinence. In fact, I have to confess that as I was listening to you, I was saying to myself, wouldn't it be nice if all of that was said by a U.S. Secretary of State? And I hear the job is going to be empty. Are you auditioning? Would you be available? I think we ought to proceed by two stages now, a little bit of an exchange of views between us, and then I'll open the floor to discussion. And while you covered so many subjects, that would be, I think, futile to try to touch on them in our exchange, I think it might make more sense if we talked about two sort of themes that you brought up. The first pertains to what might be called TAFTA, the Transatlantic Free Trade Area. What does it mean politically? What does it mean strategically? What might be some of the phases of moving towards it? Mm-hmm. And then the second issue, or large set of issues that I would like to raise with you, pertains to your emphasis on that part of the world, which in some of my writings I call global Balkans. Mm-hmm. Global Balkans. That is to say, the area from Suez to Xinjiang, from southern Russia to the Indian Ocean, which today in international affairs replicates the suction effect of the troubled Balkans on the European power structure. So let's start with the first, the transatlantic free trade area. What is your sense actually of how one might move towards it? What do you have in mind in terms of the time phase involved in progressing significantly towards its achievement? And what would be the political and maybe even security ramifications of it?
I think the security ramifications will be sort of indirect in the sense that it will sort of just demonstrate the significance of the Atlantic area, even in an age where we have the rise of the Pacific and the rest of the world, significant as that is. But these are the economies that together is sort of half the global economy, and this is the dominant part of global trade. So if we can move that forward better, there are obvious benefits to our respective economies, and we do need more of growth, we do need more of jobs, but that also benefits to the rest of the global economy. How does one then move it forward? Well, first one sort of decides to do it. I mean, that's the first step, and we aren't there yet. There has been, if you look back, a number of people are saying, probably including myself, by the way, that we should focus instead on the global trade round, on the Doha round. That would have been better, as a matter of fact. But that didn't work. We have to recognize reality. And as I said, from the European Union side, we are negotiating one free trade agreement with the one part of the world after the other. Then we must do it with the United States. Then it requires a political mandate. We need a political mandate from, or the Commission to be precise, from the different member states. Whether there will be sort of, and be precise, I would be quite certain that there will be X numbers of special interests saying we are in favor, but not in this particular area where I happen to have an interest. And I would not be entirely surprised if you might find the same sort of sentiment on the Hill here in Washington. Special interests have a track record for trying to undermine trade deals of this particular sort. But then you have to see in an age where we do need economic reforms, we do need economic opening in the Atlantic world as well, there must be from the top a decision to do it and then break the opposition that is there. Once that is done, I think it can be done in a couple of years, and I think that would be very significant.
Now, the United States, in spite of occasional regionalism, and certainly in spite of special interests, is fundamentally an integrated national economy, mm-hmm. and an integrated financial system. Mm-hmm. That is not entirely true of the European Union. Mm-hmm. So what would be the differentiating impact on the European economies of a free trade agreement between the European Union and the United States?
Well, I mean, we are in these respects, we are a sort of an integrated economy. I mean, we have trade policy is truly integrated. Internal market policies are integrated in Europe. We are not entirely integrated in sort of the financial sense in every single respect. Same, by the way, applies to the United States. I mean, prior to becoming foreign minister, I was on the board of a major financial institution headquartered in Baltimore. And I think we were sort of operating under Maryland law. But we had to spend tons of money, some lawyers explained to us the different legal frameworks of California, Maryland, Delaware, and the complexity of that was, in my opinion, nearly of European dimensions. I mean, you are still more integrated than we are. But I'm surprised by the amount of difference there still is in the
right, US. But we're not likely to have the kind of a situation that Europe has today, which, let's say, ranges at the bottom from Greece at the top to, let's say, Sweden. That's unlikely in the American context. Couldn't a free trade area agreement create greater pressures towards such differentiation in Europe?
I think a free trade area would, first it would facilitate the trade flows. I think it would create better possibilities for the, because it's easier to do trade, of course, in goods of different sorts. Services become somewhat more difficult, but I mean, that's an important area. I think it would be perhaps even more important for the countries of Southern Europe and for their economies to access the European market than for, of course, US to access the European market. Now, it has to be said that customs barriers are not necessarily too high. What it would have to involve in amount of regulatory coordination as well. That's always complicated because then you are up against different vested interests, but it's doable. And here, of course, we are doing that in Europe all the time. I mean, the single market legislation is extremely complicated but extremely important. But we have to take part of that and make it transatlantic. Everything is doable, and the benefits are huge.
Well, it's doable. I was impressed, frankly, by the 2 years. I thought it would take considerably longer than that, but I hope you're right.
Yeah, it could.
Let me shift to the other set of issues, global Balkans, the Middle East, and so forth. Implicit in what you said, or maybe even explicit, was in effect a kind of a challenge to the United States to get going, to become serious about peacemaking.
Yeah.
And I happen to share that sentiment. Mm-hmm. But how, in your judgment, can the United States play the role of mediator if at the same time the United States sees its security interests, its national interests, far more closely aligned with one of the parties to the conflict than with the other?
Because if you see yourself as aligned primarily to the security interests of the one party, the security of that particular party is dependent upon what happens with others. I mean, there's no way that that particular country, whichever it can be, can have security long-term in confrontation with the rest of that particular region. It's simply not doable. It's doable short-term, but it's never doable long-term. So I think even with respect for the strong link that is there between the United States and Israel, that's a benefit in this particular respect when it comes to moving towards peace. But the security and the stability of Israel can, over time, never be fully guaranteed in a region of increasing hostility to it, if that is what happens. And if the two-state solution is gradually more and more undermined at the same time as we have political forces in the region that might be moving in a more sort of religious direction, which includes Israel, by the way, and the forces of secularism are sort of undermined not only in the Arab world, then, of course, the security of Israel will be endangered over time, and accordingly, the fundamental interest of the United States.
Well, how far would you be prepared to go if you were the Secretary of State of the United States in persuading those in Israel who do not look at the problem that way to come to share our perspective?
Well, first, it is they who have to make the peace. I mean, we have to have respect for the peoples that are living in the region. So there are elements to how much you can actually dictate, even if you were to try. Yes. We'll try to do that. Oh, yeah, that's better.
Oh, yeah.
Was that better?
Yes.
Thanks for pointing it out. I think what we can do is perhaps the international community is to set some of the parameters for a solution. I think to a large extent we've done it, perhaps not quite. And then to help and facilitate with the different solutions and perhaps the different other aspects that they might need in order to move forward. We all know roughly what a deal would look like, but it's a question of sort of building the confidence and seeing that the structures is there. It's exceedingly difficult, and even if one were to, here in Washington and in the European Union, do everything that I would like us to do, there's certainly not any guarantee of success. But I think trying would be extremely important in containing all of the forces that otherwise are going to drag the region off in a different direction, and that would be profoundly dangerous.
Turning to Iran, you emphasize the risks and the destructive consequences of a military collision with Iran. The President of the United States has repeatedly said that he will not countenance an Iranian nuclear capability and that all options are on the table. That at least seems to imply, although it is not binding, the possibility of the use of force by the United States. I personally don't accept that, because it seems to me that we have to face openly the fact that a war in the region would set in motion a chain of unpredictable events that could be enormously destructive to our own national interest and to the region. And I infer from the points that you made that you basically share the same concern about the consequences of a military collision. That has led me, in turn, to argue that instead of suggesting that we will use force, it would be more constructive and probably more effective and far less destructive if the United States, instead of hinting at the possibility of the use of force, took publicly the position that in the event of the absence of agreement with the Iranians regarding the nuclear program, the United States commits itself to a posture regarding any Iranian threat of use of force, not to speak of the actual use of force, against any Middle Eastern country friendly to the United States, and particularly so Israel, as a threat or an action directed against the United States, calling for the same kind of consequences that would have been generated either by Soviet attack on Western Europe or by a North Korean strike against South Korea or Japan. In effect, an adoption of a binding commitment to deterrence, thereby neutralizing any possible military significance of an Iranian acquisition of nuclear weapons, because it is ultimately altogether far-fetched to argue that the moment they have one bomb, they'll rush off to commit suicide. What would you think of such an approach as a way of stabilizing the situation in the event the negotiations don't yield the desired result?
Well, first, I think that we are at a moment where I do think that there might be the possibility of moving forward with a negotiated solution that creates confidence among us that they are not moving towards towards a nuclear bomb or nuclear weapon capability, however you define it. I mean, there's a sort of ambiguity in that particular debate. There are different ways of doing that. One particular phrase referred to it, which I'm not particularly happy with, but I mean, it's one of these Washington phrases where it says all options are on the table. I don't like that.
I don't either.
My policy is that I'm in favor of all good options, but I mean, I'm against bad options. To say that all options are on the table means that also bad options are on the table. So it's an intellectually fairly funny concept that is circulating around in the debate. And it makes it sort of, it takes away from the challenge of actually looking at which are the good options and which are the bad options. And there are truly bad options when it comes to Iran, as there are bad options with virtually any other solution. So we need to see which are the good options and which are the bad options. Whether deterrence would work, I don't know, formally speaking. I find it inconceivable that there would be anyone in Iran contemplate or believing that one could contemplate the use of nuclear weapons against any of the other states in the region without having far-reaching, devastating consequences, the one way or the other. for the security.
Yeah, but you have to remember, we're not trying to convince only the Iranians. We're trying to convince some very important friends that they're not vulnerable to an Iranian attack. Yeah. And this would be, in effect, a guarantee by the United States to do for Israel, or for Qatar, for that matter, what we were prepared to do for France or for Sweden, for that matter, even during the Cold War, and certainly for Japan or for South Korea and so forth.
Well, I mean, Sweden, as a matter of fact, is is not a bad parallel. Because we were never, we were never in a sort of formal alliance. We were never part of NATO. We were never formally covered by the nuclear guarantee or whatever you call it.
Well, you were actually.
Absolutely, we were. Absolutely, that's my point. We were, and as a matter of fact, our defense planning took that into account.
And so did ours.
and so did yours. Although we never said it.
Yeah, precisely. But so in this case, we wouldn't want to say it because the party involved, namely Israel, would want to hear it.
Yeah.
And should hear it.
While we didn't want to hear it, but we wanted to know it.
Yeah, that's right.
At that particular time. And I'm somewhat reluctant to go into that area in because as foreign minister of a country, I would be sort of reluctant to sort of have firm views on what countries the United States should extend its nuclear guarantees to. Because
well, you were pretty blunt in your comments as to what we ought to be doing.
I was. But here we go to the issue of which countries would you commit yourself to go to war for? And that's sort of ultimate.
Well, I think in this particular case, we could fuzz it by saying to our friends in the Middle East, and then specifically mention Israel, and leave it, therefore, a little bit ambiguous in some of the Arab countries because they may not always be our friends. Mm. So there's a way of handling that.
No, there's a way of handling that. There's a way of handling that.
Yeah.
But I do think that one can look at certain other parallels. I mean, I mentioned the China parallel. You can have the Soviet Union parallel as well. I mean, what we might be seeking with an element with Iran is an element of détente. Détente, you know better than most, we didn't let up the ideological fight. As a matter of fact, you might argue that détente facilitated, from our point of view, the ideological challenging of the Soviet system. But there wasn't confrontation on everything. We sought areas of cooperation with them in the mutual interest of sort of containing the risks of armed and open conflict. Something along those lines later proved to be possible with China. Then the question is the Iranian political system so utterly different that it's not even conceivable to think about it? Remains to be seen. But I think it would be irresponsible not to test the possibility seriously.
All right, well, why don't we now, since we have roughly half an hour left, turn the floor to the...
to everyone.
Are mics going to be handled to people? Is there anybody here who's doing this? All right, well, here, there's a lady right here who was the first, I believe.
Yeah.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Irina Gelevska, Macedonian TV. Mr. Bilt, you mentioned the Balkans in Europe.
Yeah.
So we are two journalists from the Balkans. I'm from Macedonia, and my colleague is from Serbia. If you'd be so kind to answer our questions. About 2 hours ago, the State Secretary, Mrs. Clinton, said that the USA supports the enlargement for the European Union. You know, the last recommendation of the European Commission, Macedonia, to start negotiation without a solution on the name dispute with Greece. Will you support, will Sweden support such a decision and the European Council this December?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Yes, okay. That gentleman there.
Brian Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics newspaper. With President Obama about to consider who he's going to nominate for a Secretary of State, and the two frontrunners, say, being John Kerry and Susan Rice, who have perhaps different instincts on how interventionist the U.S. should be in global security matters, what's your hope or expectation for the second Obama term and how interventionist it should be in places like Chad or Mali or Syria or wherever there's insecurity?
Well, I mean, the U.S. has been, I mean, look at it over a lengthy period of time. I think U.S. policy has been going from, I wouldn't call it the one extreme to the other, but it's been sort of going back and forth over this. we had a period, I mean, go back, I mentioned Somalia, the Black Hawk Down. Was 93, I think, or 90?
You're referring to the event or to the movie?
Well, start with the event and then the movie. And I'm referring to the effects of that, but because we saw clearly the effects of that, that the U.S. was dead scared for quite some time. Then that was then swinging to the extremes that we have of sort of starting to invade countries in the name of regime change and think this was a fairly simple thing to do. Now we have a period where one is talking about nation building at home, sort of indirectly saying we shouldn't do any nation building anywhere else. I mean, there has to be something in between. I'm in favor of sort of intervention, might be the wrong word, but also active engagement and involvement. But it has to be long term. If you take issues like this, there's very little that you can achieve that is stable if you stay for a short period. You need to have a lot of strategic patience when you do it. So if there should be, I mean, I'm in favor of an interventionist with afterthought and with strategic patience. I'm skeptical towards believing that you can quickly move in and fix something and then go out, because that doesn't work. And clearly, in the areas that I mention, we need a heavy political engagement from the European and the American side.
Yes, over there.
If you were nominated to be Secretary of State, but really if you were to address the Senate, how would you emphasize the importance of the ratification of UNCLOS? Because it is a major problem we're having, like with the so-called pivot. And if we don't get that passed, how can we really emphasize to the countries that we're dealing with that we're really serious about it?
Well, I've been impressed by the fact that on that particular issue there is sort of a very strong voice expressed by the U.S. military. And I would sort of if those that are somewhat sort of questioning the need to ratify might be somewhat sort of questioning the motives of the odd foreigner, listen to the U.S. Navy, listen to the U.S. Coast Guard, listen to the Joint Chiefs of Staffs and what they have to say. And they are, or should be seen, as the true guardians of the ultimate interest of the United States in terms of security. And when they are saying that it's strongly in their interest and they recommend it, I would find it, if I were a U.S. senator, to somewhat difficult to say that they don't understand what they're talking about.
All right. Okay. Yes.
Uroš Piper, Tanjug News Agency from Serbia. My question is on the Hague Tribunal. Last week, Hague Tribunal acquitted two Croatian generals for the atrocities against Serbs, and 250,000 Serbs found 17 years after they were forced to leave Croatia that nobody is guilty for that. Today, Hague Tribunal acquitted former Kosovo Prime Minister Ramush Haradinaj. And we still don't have any results from the investigation of the human organ trafficking, where the current Kosovo Prime Minister, Hashim Tači, is prime suspect. What would be your message to the Serbian people and to the Serbian victims today? Thank you.
Well, I'm not quite certain that the Prime Minister of Kosovo is the prime suspect, but I'm aware of the details of that particular case. I mean, I've always been sort of somewhat careful to sort of have firm views on what ICTI is doing, because the independence of the judiciary is an important one. Doesn't necessarily need that you need to agree with everything. I haven't read the latest things coming out of ICTI, and I'm rather careful to read it. Going back in time, I've read some of their verdicts in detail and found them balanced. I've read some that I've been sort of less convinced of. I will read these as well. Whether I will comment publicly on them is more debatable, because I'm not quite certain that I should do that. But for the people of for the people of Serbia, for the people of Croatia, for the people of Bosnia, for the people of everywhere else, I would say that focus. I, as you know, I know some of these issues. I know the pain of the past in a number of different respects. But at the end of the day, the pain of the past cannot block the possibilities of the future. So to go on with the reforms, the European path, the reconciliation that comes with people acting together. And what I've seen in the region during the past few years, cars with Belgrade license plates all over Croatia in the summer. Croats doing business and Slovenes doing business in Belgrade. Amazing fact that we have the Prime Minister of Serbia and the Prime Minister of Kosovo, in whatever capacities you prefer to say that they did it, sitting down and talking to each other. Virtually unthinkable. Even a couple of months ago, I would say, that this is happening are good signs. It might be that we should close the chapter of the tribunals, because the tribunals now have the effect of dragging us back to the past too much in a situation where we should rather... the war ended quite some time ago. Let that now go to the historians, end the tribunal, move forward with European integration and reform and reconciliation among people who used to live together and who know each other fairly well.
Very good. Yes, please.
How are you? Steve Landy, Manchester Trade. I never thought that when Mr. Brzezinski was a national security advisor for President Carter, his name would become a household name. But thank you for allowing your daughter to get up at 6 a.m. in the morning and really bring us up to date every morning, and everybody now knows how to pronounce Brzezinski.
You've just deflated me.
Just a quick question for the foreign minister. You covered all regions except Africa, which I thought was interesting. Many of us are disappointed with the European Union and particularly something called economic partnership agreements, because they, although they may be based on good motives, they are really slowing up economic integration. And recently, the European Union agreed to delay implementation from 2014 to 2016 before taking market access away from some of the non-LDCs. Is there any way that you can see that maybe you could postpone the deadline until 2020? Because by that time, the Africans plan to have a continental free trade agreement in place and then could negotiate as a group and not have the divisive force. What would have happened to the European Union if the United States had agreed to negotiate a separate agreement with Italy back in 1948, as a lot of Italians asked us, but we very nicely said, no, you unify first and then we talk to you. Thank you, sir.
Good question, to which I don't have a good answer, but I no answer whatsoever, as a matter of fact. But I do think you've got a point. Seriously speaking, I hadn't thought about that. They have the ambition, as you say, very ambitious plans to move forward with economic integration. They even plan to have a common currency. I perhaps caution them somewhat in the media. But anyhow, on the trade side, why shouldn't they be able to do quite a lot of what we've done? And whether that should lead us now to slow down and wait for that to happen? Yeah, good question, which I will take with me.
All right, over there. Okay, all the way back. All the way back, yes, the person standing.
Mr. Foreign Minister, you've been addressing a haughty perennial.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. The name is Michael Brenner from the University of Texas. Mr. Foreign Minister, you've been addressing the sort of haughty perennial of transatlantic discourse. That is the ability and the willingness of the Europeans to exercise a measure of influence on the international stage commensurate with their sort of economic capacity. It's been suggested that in order to make an assessment of this, that one look at the past, particularly the record of the past 10 years. It's been a period which has been marked by a series of sort of manifest failures on the part of the United States in trying to manage the affairs, particularly of the greater Middle East. The effects have ranged from the disastrous to the calamitous. Whether we look at Iraq, Afghanistan, the United States' sort of failure to exercise a degree of initiative that was meaningful in regard to Palestine, and now its readiness to contemplate a confrontation with Iran without ever having taken up the option of engaging diplomatically on matters that concern the legitimate interests of Iran as well as the United States. Against this backdrop, what do you suggest in the way of sort of positive indicate, or let me say, make the most important point, that in each and every one of these instances, the Europeans have followed the United States meekly, passively, obediently over the cliff. Could you suggest reasons why we should expect something more constructive from Europe in the future?
Well, you do. You have heard his speech.
No, but I mean, an element of humility is perhaps called for. I mean, one can be very critical, as you were, of what the United States has achieved and not achieved in the Middle East during the past decades. You could also go back and blame all the mess on the Brits and the French after 1917. So I don't think that anyone comes away with a particular stellar record in that particular region. I do think that we are now in an era where it's fairly obvious that Europe can't achieve peace in the Middle East. I'm not quite certain the United States can do it on its own, even if it wanted to. We need to do it together. And it might be that not even that is enough. We have new actors that are more significant. The Turks are a significant foreign policy actor. We might have our disagreements with them now and then, but they are very significant in the region. We need to have them on board. We'll see where Egypt heads. But if Egypt continues, sort of sorts out some of the political and economic issues that are fairly severe at the moment, they will have sort of a soft power influence in the region that we can't neglect either. So then it's a question of all of these starting to move together. I don't think that sort of we can have our views sometimes on U.S. policies and U.S. has our views on European policy. But, I mean, if we were to go different ways, we would neutralize each other and it would not be productive.
Let me just add to this that insofar as the U.S. capacity to influence events in the Middle East is concerned, its declining scope is associated, in my judgment, with the declining scope of presidential leadership in foreign affairs in the United States. And that is particularly true of the Middle East. The fact of the matter is that historically, several presidents were able to act, and very decisively so, because they were operating in a context in which presidential leadership on matters pertaining to foreign policy and national security was generally recognized. But the last one to have been able to do that was George Bush the First, during his famous confrontation with Shamir. The one prior to that was Jimmy Carter with Begin and Sadat. The one prior to that was Eisenhower in 1956. But since then, generally speaking, the trend line has been towards increased congressional involvement and to some extent presidential acquiescence to that process, particularly in recent years. And thus today, for example, the ability of the president to set policy for the Middle East totally in independence from congressional pressures, not to mention public pressures, is much reduced. Mm. And that creates a serious, serious obstacle to what you favor, to what I favor. Mm. And yet I do feel that a second-term president, in some ways, in the first year of his second term, has the maximum leverage. Because in the first term, these circumstances had to worry a great deal about what will happen to him in the elections. A second-term president who has just won is, in fact, at the optimum stage of his presidential freedom to act. Okay, we'll take a couple more and then we'll end. All right, all the way over there. That gentleman, yeah.
Ler Kowalewski, School of Foreign Studies, Georgetown University. My question is about Belarus, the country which you didn't mention in your comprehensive agenda. But the country to which you have developed this year very strong attachment, you personally and Sweden in general.
Attachment.
So my question is about coordinated strategy of the United States and the European Union on this country, because the United States has been consistent and tough, but not very effective so far. European Union has been consistent in sharing concerns about human rights situation in Belarus, but not effective, and not there was no concerted action within European Union. Do you foresee any prospect for coordinated strategy between the United States and European Union, and what the strategy would be to approach this very difficult situation of Belarus?
I think we, to a very large extent, have coordinated strategy. We might not be coordinated down to every single detail. But when we discuss it inside the European Union with the United States, I mean, we see eye to eye on the fundamentals. I think you're unfortunately right in your description of what we've been managed to achieve, either from the US or from the European point of view. That is, sort of, things are as they are, and they're pretty bad, mildly speaking. I think you need here to have, and we do as well, I mean, we take a somewhat longer time perspective. One of the things that we are doing, or a number of things that we are doing, we are spending quite a lot of money on sort of media that can reach into Belarus. We are financing a university only for Belarus people in Vilnius, where the people that are thrown out of universities in Belarus are given sort of a very good education. And accordingly, we are sort of building the capacity for the Belarus of the future that is bound to come. Dictatorships of this sort never last forever. And it is a sort of a Soviet remaining authoritarian regime that will not survive. Do I expect it to fall tomorrow? No, I don't. But I do expect it to fall. And then we are prepared to help. We are building up the capacity in different ways. We are trying to reach into society. We are trying to help the civil society so far as we can. We are facing some problems, mildly speaking. Mr. Lukashenko has thrown out our embassy because he thought it was too much in favor of human rights, which was, from his point of view, was entirely correct. It was. We deal quite a lot with it. And I think over time, I hope you will be able to see that our policies were helpful to the future of the country.
Yes, please. Yes, you've been very patient.
Carl?
Hello. My name is Vadim Gorbachev. I'm from the World Bank. First question is about the Middle East. It seems to me that any serious peace agreement would have a shared vision as its fundamental precondition. Shared vision that would be vigorously defended by both countries as the most viable and meaningful path forward. Why isn't such shared vision, you know, being clearly articulated and clearly pursued on both sides? And second question is about East-West balance. We live in a very dangerous world right now. And
could you speak a little louder?
We live in a very dangerous world right now, and the stakes in this game are extremely high, and they very much depend on the economic, global economic balances. What do you think are the main engines of economic growth that the West can rely on in its balancing act against the East, against China? And what are the major obstacles, what are the major counter forces against these engines of growth? Thank you.
Well, first question, why are there no common visions? I think there are. I mean, there are people who have been trying to develop this. And I think you see, look at the Israelis, an exceedingly capable and competent society and economy, which has been, might be critical of some of the policies of Mr. Netanyahu, but he was an exceedingly successful and good finance minister and took Israel from an economy that was not particularly impressive in certain respects to something that taken into the high-tech modern. Take that capability and apply it to these other countries around and you will see wonders. Take the Palestinians, who are probably the most secular, perhaps somewhat of the most well-educated in the region. A lot of them are down in the Gulf and are having extremely good jobs, and they're all over the world. I mean, you can see a natural, over time, them working together. As long as this is a national conflict, I think there are ways of sorting national conflicts out. Compromises are the nature of the game. What I fear is, of course, when the religious element becomes stronger, both in the on the one side and the other side, then things become somewhat more complicated. And that's, apart from the settlement issue, is one of the reasons why I fear that time might be running out for the two-state solution.
Well, I don't think we can have a...
Yeah. On the second question, what's our strength, sort of Europeans and Americans versus the others? I think that's fairly obvious. We are open societies. We are open to entrepreneurship and innovation. I haven't a clue what would be the drivers of our economies in 30 or 40 years' time. Did I know, or did anyone know in the 1950s about the information society and the internet and biotechnology? Unlikely, except the science fiction writers. I think we are, and they might have been wrong also, I think we are going to, the open societies and the entrepreneurial economies are going to produce fantastic things in the decades ahead. The others are catching up by copying to a large extent. They're very good at manufacturing. But so far, and the real sort of danger from that point of view, although I'm in favor of it, is of course if some of them start to develop truly open and entrepreneurial economies and societies. But as long as they don't, I mean, I have no doubt that we will be the engines of innovation and in the global economy, and that's got to be the key.
Let me just add to your first point, with which I very much agree, namely on the affinity of the Israelis and the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. I have often said that if there is a peace treaty between Israel and the Palestinians, there is a very high probability that Israel / Palestine will quickly become the Singapore of the Middle East, because the combination of the initiative and intelligence on both sides would just put them heads and shoulders over the entire region, which would benefit from such a Singapore, Israel-Palestine, in their midst. And that's one of the sort of hopeful aspects of the otherwise stalemated peace process. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. I think you have given us a remarkably broad and significant and timely strategic vision. So we're very much in your debt, and we hope your concepts will be, in fact, shaping the future. So thank you indeed.
Thank you very much.